Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through WCTCAM or restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well.
You know, Mark, I know that you always try to make healthy food choices when you're shopping for your kids in the market, and it seems as though there's an article recently in the Times about this new industry-backed label, voluntary labeling that many manufacturers have signed on to. It's the Smart Choices Program, guiding food choices.
And love having another resource out there.
Absolutely, and for products that companies that join this program, they submit their products, and the ones that the panel deems healthy choices get a big green check on the front of the box, and it says Smart Choices Program, Guide to Food Choices. Green check means it's okay.
What a great idea.
Yeah. We have here the...
Let's talk a little about the execution of that great idea.
Yeah, well, in the front page of the business section of the New York Times recently, there was a picture of some of the things that get Smart Choices. Fudgesicles, Smart Choices.
Okay.
Fruit Loops, which are a sugary breakfast cereal. Smart Choice. What the hell? Wait a second.
Smart Choices. Really? Smart Choices?
Yeah. It's funny. There's a quote from the chairman of the nutrition department at Harvard School of Public Health, and he quotes, "These are horrible choices." They're not smart choices. The criterion that they use to tell you what is a smart choice and what's not, it's a completely blatant failure. And of course, our government, you know, how our food regulators are reacting. The Food and Drug Administration sent a letter, and it said, and I quote, here's a threatening letter for you, "The agency would be concerned if the Smart Choices label has the effect of encouraging consumers to choose highly processed foods and refined grains instead of fruits and vegetables, and they're going to be watching."
Luckily, they're watching.
I'd be shaking in my pants.
You know,
over
one
that.
Of the huge problems with this, as well as a lot of federal food regulation and regulation of some of the big companies that we have out there, one of the huge problems we have right now is government is very, very slow. Government reacts much more slowly to problems than big business does. Big business, when it has an issue, when it has something that it needs to overcome, if it's in a recession or a depression or anything like that, big business has the power to say, okay, we're changing our policies right now. In 2 weeks, here's our new rollout. And government just simply doesn't respond that way. So if there's a flaw in this system, big business is going to be able to exploit it for a long time before government ever comes to intercede.
Well, and this is a private thing. It's not government regulation. Mm-hmm. So, but the other problem is, I don't think it's just timing. It's that our food regulators are in the hands of our food industry. They're, you know, they're the
pockets was a better analogy.
Pockets,
I think.
Well, the thing is, you know, the regulating bodies are controlled by the companies they regulate. Here, let me read some more about this check mark. In defending it, Eileen T. Kennedy, president of the Smart Choices Board and dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University.
Who, by the way, this is not a paid position for her. So.
Right. She says the criteria are based on government dietary guidelines and widely accepted nutritional standards. What widely accepted nutritional standards say Fruit Loops are good breakfast cereal?
Okay. Fruit Loops. Good breakfast food.
Good
forget
breakfast
it.
Food,
breakfast,
right.
You know,
right.
We're not even comparing it to other breakfast cereals. We're comparing it to breakfast food.
Right.
Fruit Loops, I believe it says somewhere in this article that Fruit Loops are 41% by weight sugar.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. 41% by weight sugar. Now, Francis and I rail on corn syrup all the time, and we say sugar is, we believe sugar is a better alternative, but sugar is still sugar. 41%. You know what? If I want to give my kid a candy bar occasionally...
For breakfast?
I will occasionally... Well, never for breakfast. But if I want to give my kid a candy bar, I will occasionally give my kid a candy bar, but what I'll say is, you know what? That's a candy bar.
Right.
What I don't want to be doing is having the government telling everybody in the world on the planet.
Not the government. I'm sorry.
This organization telling every Smart Choices organization saying, this is a smart choice. This is a good choice. This 41% sugar by weight
is a good thing to have for breakfast in the morning.
It's something to have for breakfast in the morning.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy because it pretends to be something it's not. And, you know, they say it has some vitamins. It has vitamins A and C, for example. Well, if you give your kid a candy bar and a multivitamin at the same time.
Exactly it.
You're still giving your kid a candy bar.
It's still a candy. A candy bar is still a candy bar with a multivitamin.
And it just doesn't make any sense.
But literally, that's basically what these criteria have said is it put a multivitamin with the worst food on the planet and we'll make this qualify.
Michael Jacobson, the executive director of the Center for Science and the Public Interest, which is an advocacy group which we've mentioned before on the show, he was part of the Smart Choices board and helped devise the nutritional criteria until he quit last September because he said the panel was dominated by members of the food industry which skewed its decisions. This is from the Times. It's paid for by industry is what he says, and that's it. And when he goes on to say what the guidelines, the way the guidelines work, he said, and this is a quote, he said, you could start out with some sawdust and add calcium or vitamin A and you meet the criteria, which is exactly what it's all about. Here's some more justification from Eileen Kennedy, president of the Smart Choices Board. She said the program was also influenced by research into consumer behavior. That research showed that while shoppers wanted more information, they did not want to hear negative messages or feel that their choices were being dictated to them. So they don't really want information.
They want happy news.
What they want, they don't want more information.
You know what?
They want, no matter what, they want you to say, you're good.
You know what, Francis? You and I, we're going to start a food recommending company, okay? And ours is going to have little smiley faces
on it,
okay?
Yeah, and no matter what, if it's Fruit Loops, it's...
Smiley face. This makes me smile. Food makes me smile.
But listen to this twisted logic. Research show that shoppers want more information, but they do not want to hear negative messages or feel their choices are being dictated. Okay, I want news, but I want it to be a lie. Always tell me that my popsicles I can have for breakfast. That's not the same. That does not mean you want information.
Some of the thought process here are Fruit Loops are better than having a donut for breakfast.
Yeah.
So that Fruit Loops should get the Smart Choices label.
Here, let me read. Dr. Kennedy writes. She says that Fruit Loops, for instance, the reason Fruit Loops have the Smart Choices seal. Fruit Loops are better than other things parents could choose for their children. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah,
if you give your children hand grenades, that's worse. If you give them
that's
worse.
What? You know what? A quarter gets a check mark because if you eat a quarter, that's better than eating glass. Okay? So we're going to give a quarter a check mark so you can feed your children
coins. Here's this twisted logic again. You're rushing around. You're trying to think about healthy eating for your kids, and you have a choice between a donut and cereal. So Fruit Loops is a better choice. What the F? Really? That's just the dumbest thing I've ever freaking heard
so
in my
dumb.
Life.
It's so dumb.
Well, but you know what? Donuts should also get a seal of approval because you could give them a donut, or you could just put a 1 pound box of sugar in front of them and let them eat it.
You know what?
So the donut's better than that.
Actually,
but wait a second.
A donut should get the seal because it's better than two donuts.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So a donut should get the seal.
Well, and two donuts should get the seal because that's better than a dozen. Don't you think?
Of course.
So everything should get the seal.
Yeah. Well, except for a dozen.
Freaking morons. That's just, well, anyway, there's our little piece of absurdity in the food world. If you had any questions.
Oh, there's plenty of absurdity in the food world. Don't worry about that.
Lord
almighty.
We'll
never, you know, people used to talk to us and say, won't you run out of things to talk about?
Yeah.
You know, you guys have this radio show that goes all the time. Won't you run out of things to talk about? No.
Yeah, crazy.
There'll always be dumbness.
Yeah, crazy,
that
crazy.
We can talk about.
Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC AM and restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Anne Mendelson. She is an accomplished food writer. You've seen her work in Gourmet, Savour, The New York Times, and her current book is Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Through the Ages.
Anne, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
When I first picked up this book, I thought I was picking up a book about a San Francisco councilman, but it turned out to actually be about milk, 330 pages. Why milk? Why is milk so important?
I don't know why I've always been so fond of the subject, but I have been. I grew up in a part of Pennsylvania where there used to be a lot of little mixed-use farms, and among them were many, many cows. These were not giant herds. People just had a few cows, a few this, a few that. And they were part of the landscape. And they're gone now. It's just basically suburbia. And dairy farms are disappearing by the minute. I mean, just about literally by the minute. There is almost no countryside left where you have these little mixed-use farms with little groups of cattle just sort of ambling around, grazing. Too many of the places that supply our milk are basically like factories on the hoof. And I wanted to write about something that's being lost, but I don't think it's being hopelessly lost. I think there are signs that people want to bring it back.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about milk, as opposed to, and we have a lot of farmers that we talk to on the show about this. One of the things that's interesting and different about milk, when you talk about the commodity crops that account for more and more of our agriculture and almost all of our agricultural subsidies, you talk about corn, soybean, canola. These are an interesting difference between these and the unsubsidized small farmer crops is. These large crops are storable, refinable, and don't need to come to market and be consumed fresh. And then you get into fresh vegetables, which have a certain amount of shelf life, but they come from fairly far away places. And I think one of the unique things about milk is it is, in its natural state, an extremely perishable product, which if you sort of lend, you would think would lend itself to a dispersed form of production, so there are lots of forms of production all around, so that you're never too far from a milk cow. But we've had to overcome specific things with milk farming that we haven't with other farming. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yes, I would, and it's kind of a sad assessment when you think about it, because milk being so perishable ought to be something that's dealt with locally. But at the same time, people have always treated the perishability as a handicap to be overcome. Well, that's understandable to an extent, but it didn't used to be possible to overcome that handicap of the cow being a real live animal and not a machine. The milk being so perishable, it didn't used to be possible to overcome these handicaps so massively, so drastically. There have been many, many changes in milk technology in about the last century that have tended to make it more and more keepable. People have been figuring out ways to improve the shelf life, whether it improved the milk or not, and to get it farther distances. As the number of dairy farmers has been shrinking in the United States, Canada, Europe, the amount of milk that each cow gives has been increasing. The cows have been turned into these lactating machines that are always pitted against their own biological limits. The milk, when it leaves the cow, instantly goes into a very complicated pipeline system at the farm. It is tracked to a factory, because most dairies today are essentially factories. It is subjected not just to pasteurization, but usually to a high temperature pasteurization, that extends its shelf life.
Ultra pasteurization sounds like it's really helpful.
Either what they call high temperature, short time pasteurization, or ultra pasteurization, which is at an even higher temperature. And increasingly, it's packaged in kind of laminated containers under highly sterile conditions, where the milk is going to have a shelf life of weeks or months, unrefrigerated, until it's opened.
Can I share with you that one thing that disturbed me in your narrative, and I'm rapt, and I was when I read the book, the very term recent advances in milk technology kind of scares me a little bit. It's something discordant about milk and technology, but in your book you talk about the fact that once, not only is it have we really re-engineered the way that we raise cows, how we kind of abuse cows. But once that milk comes out of the cow, the idea that, you know, milk is this pure thing that sort of comes out of a cow and is maybe heated for a little bit to clean it up and then appears on your in your kid's cereal is maybe a little bit specious, because most of the milk today is sort of ripped apart and put back together again, isn't it?
That's true. It's sort of like cracking petroleum. You take the milk, you separate it under centrifuge into the skim milk and the cream. You eventually recombine it back in different percentages that will appeal to different markets. Either you leave the skim milk totally skim, or you add half a percentage of milk fat, or 1%, or 2%. You produce different grades of cream by combining milk and milk fat.
Well, now let me clarify one thing. You point out in the book that, you know, we have this idea of whole milk. I mean, it would seem the name would imply that this is just the milk as it comes out of the cow. But even whole milk is not simply that.
It is not whole at all. It's standardized in most states of the United States. It's standardized to 3.25% butterfat. And I don't know about Canada. The milk as it comes out of a cow... Well, different cows, they vary as much as human mothers in the quality of the milk they give. But something like 4% butterfat would be not unreasonable. There are many cows of all breeds who would be capable of that.
And the other thing that would happen is it would differ by season, and that's intolerable for us.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, as Americans, we refuse to have our milk be different by season. It must be it must be the same all the time.
Yep.
Now, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about milk is I remember reading somewhere that there are really only two foods that are designed as food and nothing else. And one of them is milk and the other was honey. And those are obviously two foods that go back to biblical representations. But every other food, you know, the rabbit you had for dinner wasn't designed to be your food. You know, the fish that you had for dinner wasn't designed to be your food. But milk is produced to be eaten. That's where it comes from. And so when did milk become so seminal in Western European and especially American culture? I mean, it seems to have these connotations of superfood, healthful, feed it to your children, all-American, apple pie, milk. When did that occur?
Well, milking itself is very ancient. The first animals that anybody tried it on were sheep and goats. Cows came along a little later. The whole idea finally got exported from the Middle East to Europe. And the idea that fresh milk that hadn't been turned into sour milk, buttermilk, fresh cheese, yogurt, the idea that this fresh, fluid milk, that was superior, that was the way nature meant everybody to eat milk, that didn't really come along until about the start of the 19th century. And if you think about it, it's a kind of a funny idea, because milk really is the natural food of the baby of the species, of the animal that's giving the milk. Human milk is ideal for human babies. Cow's milk is ideal for calves, and so forth. Take the milk from the animal. Remove that milk from where it started out, and it will start turning into something else by a bacterial action. It will go sour. This is a natural process. But somehow, around, you know, between about 1790, 1810 or 20, in England and northwestern Europe, there came to be this idea that cow's milk was better than any other kind for people, and that it was better for you if it was not sour, not fermented. Now, this was a little bit before there was any refrigeration technology, so it was awfully difficult to get the milk to people in cities fresh, which is why there were a lot of really, really terrible and scandalous shortcuts, like penning up cows in the middle of a city under very, very bad, unsanitary conditions. And milking them and selling the milk as a sort of a health miracle.
Well, and you call that, and they would often in the cities, the place to get the cheapest grain would be in the used, the spent grain from distilleries and breweries. And, you know, milk got its sort of bad rap as a disease carrier from this sometimes falsely labeled milk, sometimes milk from nutritionally deficient cows. You call it in your book swill milk, I think.
Well, it was swill from the dairies, and it made the cows, the swill made the cows sick. It was not something a cow was ever meant to digest. They would be so feeble that they would have to be hauled up in a sort of a sling because they couldn't stand to be milked. And many cows died. Undoubtedly, many people died too from consuming this stuff.
So we've been feeding cows things that they shouldn't eat for a long time, not just the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I remember that in the time that pasteurization became, there was a battle to make pasteurization mandatory. There was also a movement to have certified dairies, and I think the idea there was that milk from a dairy that was inspected and certified and clean and didn't do those sorts of things and with nutritionally whole cows could produce good milk. Is, in your opinion, unpasteurized milk always a much more dangerous vector for disease than pasteurized milk?
I don't think it's always automatically, de facto, more dangerous. But it's much, much, much harder to supervise and regulate.
Well, but that was the point of the. I read about the certified dairy movement in the 1800s, and what you would pay a premium to get your milk from a certified dairy, and that would be built into the cost of milk. Because, like so many processed foods, one of the things we have is our milk is artificially cheap. It costs less as a percentage of our income today than milk did in 1950, and that's one of the reasons that dairy production, that processed dairy production, has such a hold, because there is no way to responsibly produce really good unpasteurized milk as inexpensively as you can, you know, do it on these massive scales. But, you know, there's a trade-off.
There's no way you can produce safe, unpasteurized milk on a massive scale. It's something that just intrinsically can't be produced, can't be handled, can't be shipped long distances. It has to be very, very local. Many states where unpasteurized milk is legal to be sold, there are restrictions that say it can be sold only on the farm where it was produced. Can't be transported even to the next town. It's really very difficult, with the best will in the world, it's very difficult to come up with intelligent, reasonable regulations governing the sale of raw milk.
I was very grateful to have a raw, well, not a raw milk, but a dairy right across the street. My father had a small farm in upstate New York, and there was a dairy right across the street. So we were able to go and buy raw, fresh milk, and there's really nothing like it. And we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. When we come back, will you talk to us about homogenization and why that might be a problem, perhaps even bigger than pasteurization, to the flavors of milk?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking today with Ann Mendelson. Her book on milk is fascinating. You can find out more about it or pick it up on the website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. It's WCTCAM and restaurantguysradio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful emotional and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
Ann Mendelson is our guest. One of the things that really drives you is the taste of milk. I mean, it's quite various and quite interesting. And you don't really prefer plain milk. You like it cultured or somehow fermented. Talk to us about cultured milk products. Like, you know, when I buy butter in the supermarket, I like a cultured butter. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, it means that bacteria have been introduced into the milk with cream, and in the case of butter. These are lactic acid bacteria, and they feed on lactose, which is the special sugar of milk, and that has two advantages. First of all, it converts the lactose into lactic acid and makes the milk, the soured milk, more digestible by people who are lactose intolerant, which means actually most human beings. It also creates this wonderful, slightly soured flavor, just enough to be interesting. And it somewhat thickens the milk. You will see that cultured buttermilk is a little thicker and heavier than unsoured milk. This is because some of the casein, the major milk protein in milk, some of the casein is precipitated out. It doesn't actually form a solid curd, but it's just sort of on the verge there. And I would rather taste cultured buttermilk. I would rather taste yogurt, all of these things, than plain unsoured milk. I may be in the American minority.
Well, you like that little twang.
I like that little twang. Twang, that's a good word for it. Now, cultured butter, the cream is cultured by this kind of bacteria before it's churned. And, of course, the true buttermilk, that is the liquid that separates out of the butter fat when you churn it, most of that is poured off. So you're not going to taste an enormous, conspicuous difference. But you're going to have a very, very, very subtle difference, because when you churn cream to make butter and churn buttermilk, you never get quite all of the buttermilk out of the butter. There's just these tiny, tiny, minute little droplets that are left in the butter, too small for you to taste them consciously. But they're there. They add this slight, well, you said twang, just this little bit of an afterglow to the butter. It's not like sweet cream butter. Cultured cream butter, I think, is just more interesting tasting.
I would have to say I agree. And if you like Irish butter, that's usually Irish butter is cultured butter as well. When you find it in the supermarket, you see a lot of good ones out there.
And there are people out there who are all into homogenization. They say that I'd much rather drink milk that's not cream on top and thin on the bottom. I want my milk all to be homogenized. And a lot of the milk companies will tell you that that's the way milk should be. But there's a whole faction of people out there that say that you're ruining the milk when you homogenize it, and you're making it less healthful at the same time. Can you talk just a little bit about homogenization?
Well, let me explain what it is first. You take the milk, which consists of, it consists of a water-based part and a fat-based part.
Right, and anybody who's ever had seen raw milk, the cream basically floats to the top, and the milk is and the lighter milk is on the bottom.
The heavier. It's actually heavier, although we talk about heavy cream, but heavy cream is actually lighter.
It's actually lighter. That's why it floats.
The butterfat is distributed through the skim milk, this water-based part, in these tiny little globules, very small, but they're big enough to rise to the top and collect in a layer, in cow's milk anyhow, if you let the milk stand. Now, people used to treat that as an advantage because, gee, you could skim off this top part and have cream.
My daughter likes to treat that as an advantage. She always sneaks the cream off the top of the milk.
Right. Here's this one substance, and you get two substances out of it with almost no work. Also, to people who grew up on unhomogenized milk or who learned to like it, there's something different about the flavor. You have a sense of this creamier substance kind of mingling on your palate with the leaner, the less creamy substance. That has a certain pleasure of its own. But at this point, homogenized milk, which is what you get when you take those fat globules and you smash them, so you force the milk through tiny little openings, tiny little apertures, this nozzle with little openings. The milk gets forced through that under very high pressure. The milk fat globules that would have that lovely creamy effect, they are broken down into little minute droplets, too small to rise to the top in a layer. So the milk is homogeneous. It's the same throughout.
And it'll never separate.
It'll never separate. And people have been drinking American commercial homogenized milk so long at this point, at least 50 or 60 years, that they've forgotten. People used to prefer the unhomogenized.
You could see
how rich it was or wasn't.
And we're Americans. We're way too busy to shake our milk before we drink it. Yes, come on.
Well, and, you know, I think one of the things that's very interesting is when you look at old recipes, and one of the things that we do all the time, we have a cocktail bar that Food and Wine magazine says is one of the best 100 bars in America. 200 bars in America?
100.
100 bars in America. So we research old cocktails a lot, and there are old-fashioned cocktails that call for milk as an ingredient, and specifically milk punches. And I've had some of the best cocktailians in the world make milk punches for us, and for the life of me, I can't figure out why anyone would want to drink such a thing. But like so many lost ingredients, like old grenadine or old bitters or things that you couldn't find that we had to sort of reclaim the ingredient before we could reclaim the recipe. You point out in your book, and I get it now, and I didn't think this through before, but you have a recipe for a milk punch. But in your recipe, you say only if you can get creamy, unhomogenized whole milk, And I would assume that raw milk would be even better because that was the ingredient upon which these recipes were based. So it's got to be different, right?
It's got to be different. The important thing is the homogenization, not the raw or pasteurized so much. Recipes like that, milk punch, they used to call for top milk. The top milk was the cream, of course, that rose to the top.
Well, I want to point out, and we didn't get to discuss many of the recipes, but your book is about the last half of the book, really, is adventurous, over 120 adventurous recipes that explore the riches of milk, and it's a wonderful book, and thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you.
And I want to point out to our listening audience that, yes, even in the show about milk, I can come up with a cocktail and bring that into the conversation, and that is my contribution as a restaurant guy. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, the Milky Day at The Restaurant Guys radio show.
Francis, I have a little-known fact for you.
Okay.
Anne was saying how we began to use fresh milk in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Little known fact.
Yep.
It was just a very short time after that
yeah.
that the Oreo was invented.
And I bet the Oreo back then was actually baked. I bet it was like a cookie, back when a cookie had a different meaning than it does
today. Maybe it was a little while before the Oreo was invented, but you know, those two things, magical together. Anyway, there's a listener who works for a dairy co-op.
Dude, Steve, if you're listening, oh my God.
Called Pastureland. This guy, Steve Young Burns, said, I'm a listener, sent us an email. I'd love to send you some cheeses and some butter.
He said it would be the best butter we'd ever had. And we were like, yeah, okay, we've had a lot of butter
all over the world. I've had a lot of butter. I mean, I've had Grand Cru butter from the hills of Burgundy. I've had just really spectacular butter from everywhere in the world.
We're butter fiends.
Fresh butter.
Butter from Ireland, on a farm in Ireland, and a dairy farm.
And what I will tell you, the butter I had from Pastureland Co-op that this guy Steve Young Burns sent us was unbelievable.
It's the best butter I've ever had in my life.
It was the best butter I've ever had.
He sent us a pound of salted and a pound of unsalted.
Really, really spectacular. And they also have cheeses. And Pastureland is all grass-fed products.
The cheeses were great. And the butter
were great.
Unbelievable.
The butter was unbelievable.
So, do you have the website there?
It is www.pastureland.coop.
Awesome.
Really, really spectacular. Awesome. I couldn't recommend it highly enough to the listeners.
Yeah, so that's what you
so
get.
So good job, Steve, sending us that butter. Great job.
And also, for the other listeners who make great stuff or have great stuff out there, presents to the restaurant guys, sometimes sometimes they work, you know what I mean? Who knows?
Unless we hate them, and then we'll mock you.
No, well, yeah, I guess so. Anyway, well, I hope you guys have enjoyed the hour listening to the restaurant guys. You're going to go to, what's the website again, Mark?
www.pastureland.coop.
And you're going to order yourself some butter, and then you're going to send us an email,
mark@stageleft.com
or francis@stageleft.com, saying thank you for that butter. Well, I hope you have enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on WCTC-AM and restaurantguysradio.com.